Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is We Talk Productions, one of the few black radio networks that explores solutions to issues to the black, for the black community. Presents tonight Black Urban America. All you folks that listen by laptop, you can dial 516-531-9540. The lineup is back on. On Tuesday, we have myself, Black Urban America, and my name is Kenny Jones. On Wednesday, we have The Cutting Edge with Michonne, and she'll be with us tonight as my co-host. On Thursdays, we have Port of Harlem by Wayne A. Young. On Saturdays, finish up the week, we have Provocative Thought by Carlton Steve. All programs begin at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we have a special guest. I know I always say that, but tonight we really have a special guest. I know we have politicians, superintendents, teachers, community activists, but tonight we have someone that really, really has national and international exposure. She is the professor of African American Literature in Africana Studies at Research Center at Cornell University. She had written for the New York Times, which the New York Times, folks, is a heavy hitter in the news business. She wrote for the Huffington Post. She had appeared on the Today Show, BBC, and CNN. Like I said, she's a heavy hitter. The piece that she wrote for New York Times opinion, Can We Finally Get Rid of Aunt Jemima? And also, if we have enough time, I want to explore some her other writings. She got like over 60 writings, so you know, she got a lot. She has several books. She's an author, too, as well as a professor. And to be a professor at an Ivy League university, you have to be an author as well. She wrote Emancipation Daughters. And I want her to go into that. I'm going to ask her some questions about that. So, bringing you on is Dr. Richie Richardson. Dr. Richardson, welcome to Black Urban America.
Thank you so much, Mr. Jones, for such a wonderful introduction. And I'm so pleased to be with you and your audience tonight.
Yes, we're glad to have you. And I want to introduce you to Michonne. She has her show on Wednesday night, and she co-hosts with me from time to time on Tuesday night. Michonne, this is Dr. Richardson.
Hello, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
I'm great.
Well, let's get right into it, Dr. Richardson. Why was it normal for corporations to have negative images of African Americans on their brands from the late 1800s to like a few years ago? Why did they feel it's normal to have those stereotypical images of us?
Well, I think that the reasons are very nuanced and complex, but boil down to the history and backgrounds of this society as a slave society, premised on the expropriation and, in many cases, commodification of black bodies on the slave market during the antebellum era. And so I think it's really important to acknowledge those vital backgrounds in shaping patterns that have over time been discernible in the marketplace. In the 19th century, for instance, minstrelized images of blackness circulated very freely as a form of entertainment in the American context, including in the North. And blackface minstrelsy was practiced by many, say, immigrants. And it was, as scholars such as Eric Lott have explained, an important part of their acculturation into American society. And then add to that the eventual commodification of a range of items with black caricatures, featuring black caricatures in American material culture, which, of course, in some ways mirrored the advertisements that featured runaway slaves. So the black image has always, or at least has long been, heavily commodified in this culture to begin with. And then we add the mythologies that shape the circulation of a black image, and that adds to it. For instance, the myth of the Old South was at the heart of a lot of the images of blackness that were commodified and stereotyped by the late 19th century, the myth of the happy slave, the plantation myth, and so stereotypes
even in their movies.
Absolutely, yeah. The images of the mammy, Uncle Tom, and a range of other stereotypes of blackness, of the Jezebel, all of those images are rooted in the plantation myth of the antebellum era, but the mammy figure especially. And so when we look at those backgrounds, we can really recognize what is at stake and the long history of those images. But the film images would come later, but very much are grounded in that history of black commodification within the entertainment culture of this nation that formed in the 19th century. So one of the earliest films was, say, one of Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Mm-hmm.
There, you know, we have it. And it continues. I think it's important to underscore that these patterns continue so that...
Even till today.
Absolutely. In fact, film scholars, for instance, I really admire always the statements that Spike Lee has been invested in making, and the levels on which he's critiqued these images, most significantly in his film Bamboozled. But the film scholars like Nathia Diawara have looked at this longstanding pattern of stereotyping blackness in the media. And so Hollywood, for these intellectuals, has given us the grammar book for black stereotyping in the media. And so over
Bam Peoples did something like that too. Rest in peace for Mr. Van Peoples.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Amen, indeed. Yes, I mean, so it's not like there is not...
I'm up on a little bit, Doc. I'm up on a little bit. Not that much, but on this such, I'm up on a little bit.
Oh, break it down. Seriously, yeah.
Now, are these brands, I know this might be a stupid question, are these brands trying or making an attempt to have some type of racial equality when they advertise in marketing?
Well, in some instances, I do believe they are making that attempt. But the issue is that so often they fall short and somehow miss the mark. So once my piece on Aunt Jemima appeared in the New York Times in 2015, I was consulted about market research related to her, and so knew that there was a serious effort to grapple with the image, and made suggestions myself about strategies that might be used to update her and adapt her, or, you know, replace this image even. And so
I think it should be replaced, Dr. Richardson, because when I remember the old brand, and that old brand was not appealing. And you mentioned the mammy. Mammy. Can you explain to the audience the mammy syndrome or the mammy figure?
Wow. Well, to the best of my ability, I will. Because it is a, you know, reams have been bitching about this figure. And I, in describing her, always link her to the assault on the black maternal body within slavery. I think it's important because, again, slavery was very premised on expropriating the labor of black women in a dual way. For instance, as laborers on the one hand and then as mothers on the other. Well, the mammy was more complicated than that in certain ways because the mammy was never a figure encouraged to mother and nurture her own children, but was seen as the ideal wet nurse and as the ideal servant, a happy slave who knew her place and was very invested in nurturing the children of the master class. And so there is a way that she's figured typically as someone who neglected her own children, if she had any, because she was so invested in nurturing the children of her masters. And then there was a physical portrayal of her that typically was asexual. And then she was frequently portrayed as being plump in some cases. So there's and the idea was that she was associated with certain qualities like, for instance, nurturing. And again, in a practical and material sense, she served the function of a wet nurse within slavery. And so by the late 19th century, Aunt Jemima crystallized as an emerging logo in American advertising premised on that mammy figure. And then over time, we've seen various representations of her. In the media, of course, the most famous one is Hattie McDaniel's portrayal of the mammy in Gone with the Wind. And
right.
I remember that. You know, myself. Yes. You know, I'm a huge fan of Hattie McDaniel.
She got an Oscar.
Absolutely.
Did she get a Grammy or an Oscar for that?
An Oscar. For best supporting actress.
Yes.
Now her biographer, for anyone who really wants to study Hattie McDaniel in more depth, I recommend the biography of Jill Watts, cover to cover. It is a beautiful read. A lot of people don't know her role, for instance, the role that she played as a supporter of black actors and actresses in Hollywood. You know, she would host parties at her home and really did a lot of work to nurture the blacks in entertainment. And so she's just, there's so much that can be said about how phenomenal she was and how glamorous she was. You know, she's known to...
And spoke very well. She spoke very well.
Absolutely.
So that means she was a daggone good actress.
Oh, she most certainly was. And, you know, she was known for wearing magnolias in her hair. Like in 2009 at the Academy Awards, the actress Monique paid tribute to her by wearing gardenia in her hair. And so when we critique the Aunt Jemima, when we critique the mammy, it's important to underscore that we're not trying to throw out the baby with the bathwater. It doesn't mean that the contributions of Hattie McDaniel don't matter. I mean, most of us have tremendous respect for her. And significantly, Nancy Greene is another figure. I mean, I see the backlash. Even I think our community buys into this. Like on Facebook, for instance, I've seen those posts circulate that with getting rid of Aunt Jemima, somehow this is destroying the legacy of Nancy Greene. A lot of people may not be familiar with Nancy Greene. So, to just briefly mention her, the logo Aunt Jemima emerged in 1889. It was a marketing ploy by two guys, Chris Rutt and Charles Underwood, who wanted an image for their ready-made
pancakes, and those they picked this minstrel performance and song called Old Aunt Jemima. And so that was a logo that was established by the early 1890s. And we got to remember, too, that that was also a time when lynchings measurably increased in the United States. And so the 1893 World's Columbian Exposition was, you know, a very major event that showcased the ingenuity of various states and really was in some ways even an international event. And it's significant and ironic that Black leaders were excluded from that event and not allowed to create exhibits, including the anti-lynching crusader, Ida B. Wells, whereas Nancy Green was featured in a giant flower.
Well, Miss Wells received a lot of criticism from all parts of society back in those days. She was like talk about pioneers. She was like one of the first to really speak out and even work with some of the what they were called, women refuges, or the women that was fighting for political rights. She would work with them.
Right. And the club women, especially, you know, the uplift movement, the Black uplift movement. Yes, mm-hmm. She was very much at the forefront of a lot of that activism and was a premier activist herself by the last decade of the 19th century. And so we have to ask, what is at stake in the fact that a voice like hers was silenced and excluded, and yet and still Nancy Green is given this platform. And it's the bigger hit at the exposition, featured in this giant flour barrel flipping pancakes. So what did that say about the perception of Blackness? It's like over time she embodied Aunt Jemima, at least for nearly 25 years, where she would go around and perform her. And so no one is negating the performances necessarily or the prosperity that she gained as a result of it, but, you know, just because people make money from it, just because Black people make money from things, doesn't mean they're good things.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this. I'm going to ask you a question and before I turn over to Michonne. In one of your articles, you mentioned Southern racism. We were talking about the Confederism of the South and whatnot, and you even said a couple times about how the South was a slave society. Tell me, what's the difference between Southern racism and Northern racism? I was raised up in the North, and I faced a whole lot of racism. So I want to know, what's the difference between Southern racism and North racism?
Well, Malcolm X would honestly say nothing.
okay.
You know, it's significant that I'm a scholar of Southern studies as well, and you know, even with the colleagues with whom I've worked, white colleagues, and in many cases, Malcolm X is very important as a reference point theoretically and critically for this one line basically that he uttered that described the South in the United States as being anywhere below the anywhere below the Canadian border. And so he didn't demarcate and locate the U.S. South below the Mason-Dixon line in those conventional ways, but encouraged us to think outside the box in terms of mapping the geography. And so in Southern studies, that's what we do. We're not just concerned about the literal South, for instance, that a lot of people think of with the Southern states. We're concerned about the hemispheric South, the global South. And so,
okay. North America. North America is south of the equator, right?
Well,
are we above
the equator? South from a hemispheric and global sense, because in this field it's so important to do interdisciplinary and comparative work. And so you can't really take geographies in isolation. We need to look at how abusively even, say, the U.S., say, functions as a North in relation to the Caribbean, or the microaggressions that, like my colleague Carol Weiss Davies has talked about, the microaggressions against the Caribbean that African Americans have been complicit with in some cases, like with the military. And so it's complicated in that way. And when we look at racism in the United States, like scholars like Matthew Countryman, for instance, have examined manifestations in the northern states as well. And so it's important not to, because it's easy and to presume that these policies and politics are primarily a southern thing. But I think even, you know, a lot of that we've witnessed in recent times has underscored that the problem of racism is far more widespread and rampant in this nation. It's not only evident in the South. And so the way
it's from coast to coast. It's from coast to coast to me.
Right.
It's from coast to coast.
Yeah. So we have to be careful about that, you know, categorizing and dismissing the South as, say, a pariah region or creating a sense of otherness, because I think that that doesn't serve us well. And especially I in my work have been concerned about how Black Southerners have sometimes been othered within the African-American context.
Yeah. And, go ahead, Ms. Sean. Go ahead, Ms. Sean. I know you got a couple of questions for Dr. Richardson.
Okay. Why does Jim Crow era perceptions of Black women, specifically the mammy stereotype, bring in so much profit for companies?
Yes, that is an excellent question. Well, I that it definitely has to do with those, again, those longstanding stereotypes of Black womanhood. And looking at, say, the work of people like Patricia Hill Collins in her book, Black Feminist Thought, she's talked about controlling images, like all these controlling images of Black women that have existed and been circulated over time. And so Black women, I think she does a good job in her research of describing the degradation of Black women on the auction block. You know, she looks at them even as the basis for the development of pornography in this nation when you consider their public stripping on the auction block and display. And so when we look at the way that Black women experienced routinized sexual abuse within slavery and thereafter, it's important to understand how profitable it was for some to engage in those practices, and then how much of an investment there's been in those practices. One of the best studies that I've read is Chained in Silence, Black Women and Convict Labor in the New South by Talitha LaFloria. And she's looking at Georgia specifically in terms of the way that, you know, because after emancipation, Black families began to take on a slightly new configuration and were invested in creating homes, you know, like with women who had a chance to maybe take care of their children, stay at home. And yet and still those who wanted to kind of promote sharecropping didn't like that. They wanted Black women out in the fields because, you know, Black women not being in the fields meant that they weren't making as much money necessarily. And so I think a lot of the commodification of Black womanhood has typically been invested in who can profit and benefit from it. And it's
they
also
still
been,
do that today.
Right.
Sorry for cutting you off.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that even patterns of trafficking, like trafficking, we need to understand how a lot of those patterns that are developed, I mean, that are evident in the global arena are also rooted, like traceable back to the way in which Black women were commodified within the system of slavery.
Do you think kids should attend schools named for figures whose legacy would encourage personal growth?
Well, you know, as someone who's had to say a lot about this topic recently, one of the important things to acknowledge is how complicated this issue is. I mean, I mean, even as I've advocated for the removal of Aunt Jemima, I think that I like to proceed with caution when we deal with the issue of symbols more broadly. First of all, you know, my heart goes out to George Floyd's his family and everyone impacted by his loss is so significant that protests unfolded in all 50 states and cities around the world in the wake of the tragedy. And that is how the conversation on symbols resurfaced. But I think it's a problem in a way I think we can easily end up deflecting the main issues, because the main issues have to do with encouraging police reform and thinking about, you know, how to make things better. And so I feel less comfortable with dialogues that, you know, kind of all of a sudden get derailed into an emphasis on symbols and renaming, you know, renaming streets and renaming schools. I mean, I feel that it's always, you know, crucial, but rather than, say, renaming streets, I like to see policies and practices in place designed to protect people, you know, the people on those streets. So we have to avoid smoke and mirrors.
I had another question then.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, with that said, I think it is. It does make a difference when you see themselves mirrored and reflected in the institutions that they attend. You know, that can make a difference. But I'm just saying that, like in corporations, when the goal is to change symbols and all of that, I resist changes that are merely cosmetic and that are at the surface level. I think that the changes also have to be evident in the efforts to diversify those institutions and to expand who's sitting at the table. And so similarly for schools, I think that, you know, to have the names of schools changed or to invoke these issues like in a very superficial way doesn't help if the students themselves are not being served well. You know, this is a pandemic. And
as well as the family. As well as the family and the community.
Right.
We could change all kinds of names of streets and buildings, but it starts with the thinking process of the child and also the behaviors of the family unit. Sorry for cutting in there.
So that I would suggest that it's crucial that the approaches be much more comprehensive and that there's more thinking outside the box, because we don't want to stop at the surface level where, you know, it's about just campaigning to change the names and trafficking at the level of symbols, because I feel that we sell ourselves short in that way. It's important. It's an important move, definitely. But I would say that it does us a disservice when we don't dig deeper and also work to address the glaring problems and issues.
Yeah, I want to get back to the historical advertising part. I want to move up the date a little bit. How has advertised their marketing of the Black woman been portrayed since the Black Power movement, like the mid to late 60s, since after the Black Panthers or what have you? How has Black women been advertised and portrayed on that level?
Well, again, I think it's very complicated. I'll start with maybe something closer to home, for instance. I am a huge fan of the legacy of John H. Johnson and Ebony and Jet magazine. You know,
I remember Jet and Ebony. I remember that.
Absolutely.
Don't forget about Black Enterprise and what was one more? It was like four major ones.
Sepia was a magazine. I've never really read Sepia because that was not as much in circulation during my childhood. But yes, all these magazines, Ebony was groundbreaking in challenging very narrow representations of Blackness in the media, and of course played a vital role in 1955 after the tragic lynching of Emmett Till by in Miami, Mississippi, by actually daring to print the photograph in jet. So, you know, if one looks at the archives, looks at the research, we discover that prior to that time, African Americans were largely represented as being criminals in the media, you know, or very stereotypically in the ways that we've acknowledged in this conversation. And so the efforts of Johnson Publishing to portray the Black community in much more positive ways, you know, we have to be careful, too, to not just think through that binary lens in terms of positive and negative, because it's more complicated than that in a way. But as a form of shorthand, I'll just say that. And so that was insurgent and revolutionary. And so I'm not one of those people, you know, who come to a point where I bash Ebony or Jet or say that somehow, you know, the images were superficial, because they had a purpose when they were circulated and at the time that they were circulated, and made an important intervention. And so this has been a long and lasting legacy. And so with the Black Power movement and the Black Panther movement of the 1960s, we definitely saw shifts in Black representations, including advertising, even in the
Afros, Afro Sheen.
Yeah. Well,
a lot of these products were Black owned, but not any longer.
Well, that let me just tease that out. So it's like you saw, you know, conventionally there had been skin lighteners and hair straighteners advertised even in these Black-centered magazines, and they provided crucial advertising dollars. And so by the 1960s, the late 1960s, there were shifts even in the Black press, so that we saw women with darker complexions represented, natural hairstyles. But then
speaking of lightening up the skin, don't you think that we are returning to that?
Returning to?
Yeah, the lightening up the skin. You said there was advertised about lightening up the skin. I see a lot of celebrities lightening skin again.
Well, you know, internalized oppression is a big deal, and it's there. It definitely has a continuing impact. You know, in some of my interviews, I've talked about the doll experiments, the famous doll experiments conducted by Dr. Kenneth B. Clark and Dr. Mamie Clark.
I'm aware of the doll experiments. I'm aware of that. Most of the Black girls picked the white dolls. Nobody picked the Black dolls.
Right, or associated with those dolls, or associated those dolls with good qualities. So, yes, there is strong and colorism continues to be an issue. But the thing is that even with Black Power, even with the Black Panther movement, and, you know, I think that a lot of times Black Power was not engaged in the media or popular culture in an in-depth way. Like if we read the work of Stokely Carmichael, later Kwame Ture, or and Charles Hamilton, we see that that was a major political movement based in the Black belts of Alabama and Mississippi, and manifest in organizations like the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. All of that. And yet it's
People don't give a brother Stokely Kwame Ture, no longer with us, his flowers, his and whatnot. He was very important in encouraging Dr. King to change from saying Negro to Black. And even Dr. King in the later years, his speeches, in a couple of speeches, he started mentioning Black Power, but more on an economic basis. And people just misinterpreted what Stokely Carmichael meant by Black Power. And he would just talk about the strength in economics, the strength in politics, the strength in unity and what have you.
That's right. That's right. And of course, I want to also acknowledge Mr. Mukasa, formerly known as Willie Ricks, who was a part of that moment as well in a very crucial way and helped to coin
the
concept.
What's
his name? We can trace it. Mukasa is that community activist who was just such an inspiration for so many of us in the Atlanta University City Center coming of age in Atlanta. But and Richard Wright helped to lend out the concept of a black power as well, you know, back in the 50s.
Right.
And so, yeah, excavating it is crucial and looking at all of its layers. But what I want to emphasize is that the sloganeering, you know, the images like the natural hair and the fist were readily commodified in the media, but often the substance of it, of its platform, was obscured. And yet it's still black power, and it's never meant what some people presume. Like, it's never been about achieving black supremacy or any of that. That's not what black power was about. It was about gaining more of a voice and actually gaining access to voting rights. And so everything that we see now with Stacey Abrams is intimately rooted
from
in
Georgia.
History.
From right. Georgia. She ran for governor. Yeah.
Yes. I just admire her a lot for her work.
Mayor Bowers did a pretty good job in Atlanta with all the she wasn't given all the resources that she needed, but with all the limitations that she had, she did pretty well during the pandemic. I got to give it to her, Ms. Bowers. What's at stake?
Yes.
If we continue to have these products market us or black women under today's stereotypes. I mean, we talk about the 50s, the 60s, 70s stereotypes. How about today's stereotypes that are, I shouldn't say stereotypes, images, today's images. What's at stake now?
Well, I would say that, first of all, we have to nuance what we're talking about and thinking about in terms of images, because although, you know, there are images that are obviously stereotypical, there are often differences between images that, say, are produced in the mainstream and then the ones that African Americans and others of the African diaspora and Africa produce to reclaim their bodies or to express themselves. And so how do we draw the line? For instance, if black women are participating in, say, more sexualized representations of themselves, then are these images that we want to put in that category as well? And when we do, to what extent are we overlooking, you know, the freedom of people to express themselves? So I just wanted to nuance it to show that even in black popular culture, these issues are never really cut and dried.
Right, right. Go ahead, Michonne.
Okay. Do you agree or disagree that the word plantation romanticizes the Old South of slave economy for white people, and for black people, it evokes the past of slavery?
I think at a surface level, definitely that happens, and that in a way the word is inextricable from those histories. You know, we've seen so much nostalgia at times persist in relation to plantations, and I think that, I mean, I don't think the answer is necessarily erasing history, as some people call it. But we're talking about certain forms of plantation tourism and romance that are being promoted in this day and time. Then that can be more problematic, because then, you know, we have to think about how variously people respond to these histories and representations. And so when concepts like that are so intimately linked to black pain and trauma, it's hard for us to think of those terms in a more neutral way.
I agree, because when I go out to like Lowe's, Home Depot, and I go by these, they have plantation blinds. They have a lot of things with the name with it. They have plantation weddings, et cetera.
Right. Right. Well, you know, on my campus a few years ago, the organization, the student organization, Black Students United, successfully challenged a botanical area on campus that was called Cornell Plantations and urged the renaming of it for precisely all those reasons. And, you know, there are important conversations unfolding about the history of slavery and the making of higher education. Craig Stephen Wilder is unsurpassed in researching this history. He's on the faculty at MIT, and I mean, he's such a brilliant person. And so a lot of that conversation has been picked up, you know, within the Black student movement that has unfolded over the past decade, where, you know, buildings are being rethought in terms of being named for people who own slaves in some cases on campuses and that sort of thing. So this is a big and broad issue, and every institution is typically finding its own way and path to examine their histories where they want to, you know, grapple with these issues more seriously. But all, like, forms of tourism in general have the potential to, say, objectify people. Like, in the wake of the horrific tragedy of Hurricane Katrina in 2005 in New Orleans, you know, the fact that there, some were engaging in tourism of the Lower Ninth Ward and that sort of thing, you know, who does that? I mean, I think that they're, if we're looking for ways to help remedy and maybe address, like, persisting inequality, that's one thing. Like, for instance, I'm a fan of Beyonce's work in formation, because in 2016 when she did the visual album Lemonade, the memory of Hurricane Katrina was not as familiar for, say, people of new generations, and so she brought that really back into prominent memory because, you know, when it happened, it was just so acute and a concern for many, and a lot of people have been displaced from their homes. And so these issues have a continuing impact that remains invisible. And I would say that everything that we're seeing now in terms of the benign neglect of the government that some people began to feel once the pandemic began was an extension in some ways of those forms of neglect that some people critiqued in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, you know, when the levees
broke. And guess what, Dr. Richardson? There are a lot of people from that area that weren't allowed to return.
Which is not ideal, because it gets into those other issues. You know, right now at Cornell, I am teaching a course that it has been such a blessing and privilege to be a part of, co-teaching it with the architect Peter Robinson. It's called the Design Justice Workshop. Like, our whole class went to New York City for a week, like week before last, and we toured Black heritage sites, primarily the Brownsville Heritage House in Brooklyn, yes, all of those areas. And then we looked at conservation practices at MoMA. We examined, or the Museum of Modern Art. We toured the Black heritage, I mean the African burial ground, and the lower part of Manhattan. We took Kamal Ware's Black Gotham tour, which takes us back into just what it was like to have been a slave, enslaved, you know, in the colonial era. And we also spent 2 days with the preservationist and historian Michael Henry Adams touring Harlem. And so the whole course is premised on the othering of Blackness in spatial environments, and the collective Black space, the architectural collective Black space, is about underscoring how much Blackness matters, even when we're conceptualizing who should be included in spaces or how we can make spaces better, because the pattern and the tendency has been to alienate and other Blackness, when the truth is that if Black people are included, then there's ingenuity, there's talent, there's value that's added.
Skills, abilities, resources.
Yes. Yes.
Creativity.
That's right. Yes.
Now, it's something that you brought up, Beyonce. I just want to touch on the few minutes we have left, I just want to touch on Emancipation Daughters. You know, the five sisters that you select to write about in your book called Emancipation Daughters. Could you go? I'm going to ask you some questions about that. Could you explain to the audience about Emancipation Daughters, the book that you just written? I think you just wrote that book, right?
Yes. Well, yes. Just finished it last year.
Okay.
It's been a long time in the making. Yeah. Well, and it's my second book. The first actually focused on Black masculinity and is entitled Black Masculinity and the U.S. South from Uncle Tom to Gangsta. And so this follow-up is also invested in looking at...
Yeah, I want to bring you back. I would like to bring you back in a couple of months before either, I guess, on spring break or something like that to talk about that book. I'm interested. I might even purchase that book. And I'm interested to see what you got to say about Black masculinity from slave to gangster.
I saw that. So the way to understand this one is that it picks up kind of where that one leaves off in terms of thinking about, like, I'm looking at more at stereotypes of Black masculinity in that book. And I say that in this book, I take the high road. And so, like, the stereotypes of Black women that have been nationalized, of those stereotypes, Aunt Jemima, for instance, is the most prominent one. Well, I'm less invested in studying the stereotypes in this book than I am in looking at those illustrations of Black women who have emerged as national icons in this nation and who have become embodiments of national femininity and even national mothers.
Black femininity.
Yeah, that this.
For our sisters to look up to. Not look up to, but look at their images of what they completed, what they had to say, what their platform was, because you picked out some heavy hitters here, Dr. Richardson. Tell the audience who you picked, who you selected.
Right, because this book could have been mapped in any number of ways, but I chose to focus on Mary McLeod Bethune, Rosa Parks, Condoleezza Rice, and Michelle Obama. And then Beyonce as well as a popular illustration of Black women who have developed national platforms and voices, who have over time helped to construct policies and platforms that have centered Black families as well as children, and that they have contributed in vital ways through their writings and speeches and helped to create a more inclusive, like they help us to envision what a more inclusive American democracy can look like.
How did each woman contest racism in their own way? Because you have different periods here, like Mr. Doom was back in the 50s, right? 40s and 50s. Rosa Parks in the 50s.
That, like during the
Rice was
like
in the 90s. You know, I mean, she's still prevalent because she's teaching at Stanford, right?
In the Hoover Institute.
Huh?
Yes. In the Hoover Institute, as I understand it.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Michelle Obama. Of course, everybody knows who Michelle Obama is. Beyonce is Michelle Obama and Beyonce and Condoleezza Rice are more modern women, I guess. So how did they each contest racism? Or was there any illustration they had to address racism in their own field?
Well, one thing I do is to show how much they very subversive and resistant images over time. And so I focus on historical periods beginning with the historical arc that I cover dates back to the post-emancipation era. And is very invested in thinking about the long and continuing process of emancipation in the United States, somewhat, you know, referred to it as the unfinished business of emancipation. But the Depression era is what comes into relief very strongly in relation to Mary McLeod Bethune. And so I'm invested in looking at how she emerged as a national leader by working in the black cabinet of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and also the way that she helped to develop a national platform for black women as activists through the National Council of Negro Women. And mm-hmm. in the book, I'm looking at the contestations, nevertheless, because of her over her becoming, like, Council House, the headquarters of the NCNW, becoming a national historic site. And so, you know, that famous letter that she wrote, her last will and testament, published in Ebony, is a document that I closely read in that book, as well as the monument dedicated to her on the nation's capital, the first to any African American ever. So that's the concern there. And then with Rosa Parks, you know, I think it's so important for us to continue to challenge the mythologies about Rosa Parks. I love the way that Jean Theo Harris, the historian, takes on some of those myths, as well as
there's been so much work on Rosa Parks. They even made movies about her.
Absolutely. But one issue is that the movies and cultural productions are often invested in propagating a myth of quiet strength in relation to Rosa Parks. And I feel mm-hmm. that even scholars and historians often overlook the voice of Rosa Parks herself, you know, and so we can't overtalk her. And so what I do in my book is to go back to her writings, you know, because she was very invested in children always. And so I do an examination of the Children's Museum in Montgomery, Alabama, which is my hometown, and think about how it extends the work that was so important to Rosa Parks with the Rosa and Raymond Parks Institute that she established in Detroit. And also, you know, look at the way in which she addressed her young audience and what she encouraged them to do in terms of dreaming and claiming the agency to reshape and create a better future. You know, Rosa Parks always had a kind of ministry and mission focused on children. And so my book brings that into relief. In the Condoleezza Rice chapter, I deal with a more reactionary illustration of black women's power. And so that is, it's probably my favorite chapter in the book, because it's the home base. That's home in the book, because Condoleezza Rice was who helped me to begin to think about the possibilities for black women to emerge as national icons. I mean, you know, that history has been long. We can take
that. No, Ms. Rice was international. She was Secretary of State.
Right.
She's an international icon.
Absolutely. The most powerful woman in the world, as she was referred to. But, yeah. You know, this phenomenon of black women's national iconicity is longstanding. It even was true with Sojourner Truth. It was true with Harriet Tubman. It was true with Phyllis Wheatley. It's just that a lot of times the images have been drowned out and obscured because, again, the focus has so much been on stereotypes. And
right.
So this book is in certain ways a reclamation of black women's political agency to show that when we have been represented, even though the stereotypes exist, you know, don't reduce us to that. We have always been more than that.
We got a couple minutes left. I have one more question for you to ask. I have one more question, Dr. Richardson, before I let you go. What is the image and identity of today's black woman?
Wow. I would say that the image identity of today's black woman is infinite. It's as diverse as the black women out there. You know, we don't have to fit ourselves into a box. You know, I have long time been, like, all my life really collected dolls. In childhood, I had over 100, and now I would say there are at least probably 150. And I don't even consider myself a real collector, but there's the scholar, Anne Dufil, who's talked about ethnic Barbie and how in creating a black one, it still ended up reinforcing stereotypes of how black women look. But the truth is that when we think about black women and who we are, it's important to think outside the box because, you know, we are so infinitely diverse. you know, a lot of these conversations often say Black, queer, and trans women are marginalized and excluded, or the unique precarity that, say, Black trans women have faced is not really acknowledged. And so I think that when we think about Black women and who we can be, we have to really think outside the box and understand that God created all of us fearfully and wonderfully made. And so, you know, we shouldn't necessarily place limits on how, like, or suggest that, like, there's this one model or mold that embodies Black womanhood. I mean, I think that there's definitely that tendency, and there are definitely figures who provide important, you know, they're important role models and can provide inspiration. But in creating those ideals, we always have to raise questions about, well, then who's left out, who's excluded as a result of that?
Well, let's go back to say that Black folks are monolithic people. We are a wide range of thoughts, ideology, characteristics, images, styles, creativity, and what have you. Well, Dr. Richardson, I would like to thank you for coming on to the show. This has been educational and stimulating. And I know with the people downloading this show, they're going to learn a lot. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Well, it has been an honor and a pleasure to talk with you all, and thank you for you both for having me. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Michonne, what's going on tomorrow night?
Current event.
Huh?
I'm going to talk about what's going on right now. So it's going to be current event.
Oh, current event. Okay, folks, that's it for this week. We got a lineup for you in November. Just tune in every Tuesday. Keep on downloading the shows. Thank Dr. Richardson. Check out her books. She got a website, Richie Richardson. Or you could go check her out on the university website. She's on there. She's everywhere. So, okay, folks. That's it for this week. Everybody have a wonderful week. Thank you for tuning in. As always, I am because we are. We are because I am. Good night.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading the